Colin Kibitsky joins me this week to discuss oxygen and its effects on finished beer. This is Beersmith Podcast number 293.
This is the Beersmith Home Brewing Show, where brewing great beer is our passion. If you want to take your brewing to the next level, visit beersmith.com, where you can download a trial version of our Beersmith software, subscribe to the newsletter, and get dozens of free articles on home brewing. And now, your host and the author of Home Brewing with Beersmith, Brad Smith.
This is Beersmith Podcast number 293, and it's late November 2023. Colin Kaminsky joins me this week to discuss oxygen and its effects on finished beer. Thank you to this week's sponsors, Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine. They invite you to join their upcoming brewery workshop, March 24th to 27th in Austin, Texas. This one-of-a-kind event brings together professional brewers to help you start or grow your own craft brewery. To learn more, please visit breweryworkshop.com. Again, that's breweryworkshop.com. And also the American Homebrewers Association. The Homebrewers Association invites you to join today and get a free bonus book. Join for 1 year and select a free brewing book for more than 60 titles to match your fermentation goals. Visit homebrewersassociation.org to join the American Homebrewers Association and treat yourself to a new brewing book. And Beersmith Web, the online version of Beersmith Brewing Software. Beersmith for the Web lets you design great beer recipes from any browser, including your tablet or phone. Edit recipes on the go with access to the same full suite of recipe building tools as our desktop version. Try Beersmith Web today by creating a free account at beersmithrecipes.com. And finally, a reminder to click that like and subscribe button on YouTube, iTunes, Spotify, or whatever platform you're on. Clicking those buttons is a great way to support the show. And now let's jump into this week's episode. Today on the show, I welcome back Colin Kaminsky. Colin has been brewing beer professionally and designing brewing equipment since 1998. He is an R&D designer for the Pro line at More Beer, and he's responsible for designing the MB line of Pro equipment. He's also a brewmaster at Downtown Joe's in Napa, California. And finally, he's the co-author of Water, A Comprehensive Guide for Brewers, as well as many BYO articles. Colin, always a pleasure to have you on. How are you today?
You know, I'm good. Thank you for having me, Brad.
My pleasure. What have you been doing in the brewing world lately? I think you mentioned, we were talking before the show, you mentioned you've been designing a lot of equipment.
Yeah, I do lots of drawings these days. So at Downtown Joe's, my responsibilities are 1 day a week. I write the schedule for the brew house. I do all the ordering, all the scheduling. I get to brew if I want. I don't have to brew if I don't want. So that's kind of fun. So I get about 20 batches in a year there. But then at More Beer, I do a lot of drawings. I've drawn all of their pro tanks, been working on some pro brew houses, both electric and oil heated, some grain mills, some other stuff. So lots of drawings, lots of technical drawings. I drew the whole Forge Fit line of TC fittings. So most of my days are spent, at the CAD station, doing technical drawings.
Well, Colin, today you wanted to talk about oxygen and beer. What role does oxygen play, first of all, during fermentation, and then why is it critically important to get the oxygen out once fermentation is done?
You know, so it's very interesting because we talk a lot about oxygen and brewing, and certainly, I started pro brewing in 1998, and it's something I've thought about a lot. And there's really three places that we talk about oxygen, and they're really very different spots. And mm-hmm. So it's convenient to think about them as three unique things. One is the hot side aeration. How much air did we introduce into the wort before fermentation? And then what I call oxygenation, which is how much oxygen do we add to make the yeast healthy? And then the final thing is any oxygen that gets in post-fermentation. Now, the post-fermentation is the most critical stage by far. And we all know, I hope we all know, that keeping out as much oxygen after fermentation is the most important job of a brewer. I mean, if you want your beer to last more than a few weeks, you really have to try to minimize oxygen all the way through that. And we have all sorts of best practices that we use both in pro brewing and home brewing to try to accomplish that. And I always thought, oh, I'm doing a pretty good job. Well, other day, I was very lucky. I got to borrow an Anton Parr C-Box. Mm-hmm. Now, this is a $22,000 machine that just measures package oxygen. How much oxygen did you get in the can? And I or the bottle. And I had this big chamber that you put a bottle or a can in, and you turned on a switch, and a big needle slams down and pierces the lid of the bottle or pierces the can. You can put soda bottles in it. It'll do pretty much anything.
Wow.
And then it puts about 100 PSI of nitrogen in to make sure that everything stays in solution, and it starts pumping it through the machine. The machine then gives you readings. It gives you dissolved oxygen first. What we measure at that point is total package oxygen. And then as it moves along, it collects about an ounce in a special chamber and measures how much CO2 is in. So you end up with a very accurate oxygen, like around 1 ppb, maybe even finer measurements than that, 0.1 ppb of oxygen measurement, and then 0.01 volumes of CO2. So we had a really good idea of what was in. We were transferring from kegs to cans, and we had a really good idea of what was in these kegs as far as package oxygen and CO2 levels. Then we could measure it in the can, and we could compare the two. Did we lose any CO2? Did we gain any oxygen? And what were the parameters that, mm-hmm. that allowed us to do that? And all of the things I've been taught, all of the things that we've all been teaching over the years, they're all true. They all make a big effect on oxygen. What I didn't realize is that it's not a, if you do this, you're going to get 50 ppb, and if you do it wrong, you're going to get 60 ppb, and if you do it really wrong, you're going to get 80 ppb. That's what I was expecting. Fine.
Okay.
Just because I had no experience. But it turned out that if you did it perfectly, boy, we could pick up less than 10 ppb. And if you did it where it was like, oh, that wasn't quite perfect, but it looked pretty good, that was 100 ppb. And if it was like, oh, well, that one didn't go well at all, but we'll accept it, that was, 4,000.
Wow. Orders of magnitude, huh?
Yeah, orders of magnitude. And that was what was really shocking. We've always been taught, well, cap on foam. Well, that makes sense, right? The foam doesn't have as full of CO2 bubbles. Well, it turned out that if you capped on foam with big bubbles, then you picked up a bunch of oxygen. If you capped on foam that was really tight, like the crema on your espresso, then you got the minimum amount of oxygen. All of those little factors that we've all been watching turned out to have really dramatic effects on the total package oxygen.
Wow. And can you tell me the process you do go through to package your beer? I assume you're talking at the brewery, right?
Well, so we were at More Beer, and we were testing a pro canning line that some friends of ours in Australia had designed, and we were a little uncomfortable selling it until we knew that we could technically support it, that we had valid numbers that we could advertise.
Sure.
If you tell somebody, oh, this will do 5 ppb, and they go through everything in the world and can't do any better than 100 ppb, everybody's going to be upset. So we wanted to see what realistic numbers were. And I had a checklist that a friend of mine had given me of, well, when you're looking for oxygen pickup, these are the places to look. And everybody thinks, oh, well, it's all in the fill head. If the fill head's designed right, it's going to work perfectly. And really, the fill head doesn't change, right? So we had no control over the fill head. We could adjust purge times and some things like that. But the first big dramatic source of oxygen was a leaking fitting.
Huh.
And you're thinking, well, you know, of course, beer's coming out, so you would expect oxygen to come in. This fitting was not leaking beer out. It was only leaking oxygen in.
Wow.
And tightening it dramatically reduced the oxygen.
That's amazing. How did you even find the fitting then?
We just tightened everything.
Okay.
And magically, you know, the whole machine's just running, you know, an order of magnitude better. And one of the fittings was, you know, noticeably loose. It was like, oh, okay, this has got to be fitting. And it was just one of these push to connect beer fittings that had threads on one side and push connect to the other side. Added a couple turns to it, and all our oxygen problems went away.
Wow.
So, and then the C-Box was just phenomenal. I don't think without this machine, even had a prayer of getting something that was shelf stable in the can. So we had lots of kegs of Lagunitas IPA. That's what we chose.
Okay.
And this machine would just burn through kegs so fast that we'd measure each keg. We had a setup where we could pump beer out of the keg through the C-Box.
Mm-hmm.
Then we would can it, and then you'd shake the can for 3 minutes to get all of the air that's in the headspace back in the beer, and then you'd run it through.
Hmm.
And Lagunitas was remarkably consistent, which is what we expected. It was about 24 ppb of oxygen in the kegs.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this isn't a fair test because as time goes on, the machine's going to pick up less oxygen in the keg. So these kegs, you know, didn't just come off the keg filler. They'd gone to a distributor. We'd bought them. We'd stored them for a few days. So some oxygen disappears from the C-Box. That's a really important thing to remember when you're canning. You want to test these things right away. Just pull it right off the can line, start shaking.
So you're talking about parts per billion, obviously. What levels of oxygen are kind of considered bad in say, a commercial beer?
So this has changed a lot over the years. I remember in the 90s, you know, a very big brewer was hosting Master Brewers Association, and they were bragging about how they could do, you know, 3 parts per million pickup. So that's 3,000 parts per billion of pickup on their really expensive canning line. Now breweries are running under 20. Some breweries are running under 10, even with not the state equipment. 10 people.
Wow.
And so if you're doing really good, you know, you've got your bright tanks purged really well. You've got all your lines purged really well. You should be able to set everything up to under 10 ppb of pickup. It's just absolutely fascinating. We purged the lines with water thinking that would help the oxygen levels. And it was actually terrible for the oxygen levels because tap water, even running straight out of an RO filter with no aerator, was running 4,500 ppb.
Wow.
And it took a lot of beer to rinse that out.
Yeah, and I imagine if I took water out of my tap with the aerator, it would just be off the charts, right?
It would be beyond where the C-Box could measure. Yeah, it would be out of scale.
Wow.
The C-Box instructions tell you not to trust 1,000 ppb.
Hmm.
So yeah, it when we did it, because we did hot and cold water, just because I wanted to know, off the scale. And just phenomenal. You know, so we played with deaerating water, took a homebrew kettle, heated the water up to 210, let it cool, naturally didn't try to any forced methods of cooling. And that was the lowest we could get, but that was still pretty high.
Yeah.
You know, still over 100. And that was remarkable. We were expecting that, heating and cooling water, we'd be able to get it much lower.
So, compare, you know, what kind of process do you go through with this canning line? Is it purging all the cans? I mean, what steps is it taking to help reduce the oxygen level in the beer?
So this was released out of Kegland in Australia, and it's a you know, professional line. It's like $35,000.
Yeah.
And so we found rinsing the cans made it awful because we couldn't get the oxygen down low enough in the water. So we were blowing out the cans and putting them on the line. The two heads would drop down, and they would give us, the first head would purge CO2, and then the cans would move one slot over, and the second head would fill with beer. The fill nozzle has a valve all the way at the bottom of the can, right? So it's a plunger that goes down through the head to open a valve all the way at the bottom. And the beer would come in and fill pretty quickly there. And we would have to set, the fill rate was set by pressures. You would increase the keg pressure if you wanted the fill rate to go higher, to go faster. Then the fill head was pretty big, so it would start to pull out before the can was full. Right before it would exit the top of the beer, it would add more beer. And it had a flow counter so that you knew we were filling 500 milliliter cans. Mm-hmm. So we would have it set exactly to 500 milliliters. So it would do 425 milliliters. Then right as the arm was lifting out, it would do that last 75 milliliters. That would create a little bit of foam. If that foam was nice and rigid so that the lid was just floating, the automated system would put the lid on. Sure. And it would just be floating. But not very high, like a millimeter off on this really thick, hard foam. Hmm. And we capped it. That's when we got our best results.
Wow. Amazing.
And it automatically just went into the seamer. Then a rinser would rinse it, and it would go on to the outfeed. And the way we had the machine set up was very labor intensive. You only had four cans on the infeed and four cans on the outfeed. So it was two people running around pretty good. And the whole time we're trying to video all of this so that we could see what we were doing, compare the numbers.
Quite a few more steps than probably an average homebrewer would take. Huh?
Well, so let's think about that. Let's say you had a little canning machine at home. You know, whether you have the October
or bottling, or
bottling, right? So you're probably sanitizing your bottles and putting them on a bottle tree. We learned that that has to be perfectly dry, that you don't want any residual liquid in there. Even though the liquid itself isn't going to change the flavor of the beer, the oxygen in the liquid will. So you want it to completely dry before you start bottling. Mm-hmm. Then you want to purge from the bottom of CO2. You want to, do your fill and cap on foam. You don't want foam that looks like it was from a soda pop. You want foam that looks like it was from an espresso. You want that big, rich foam. And then you want to cap. And one of the things that we know in pro brewing is you want the lip dry cap in a bottle. We didn't worry about it so much in the cans, but I think in a pro situation you would want the can lip dry too. Right. And that's a challenging, you want to cap on foam, but you don't want to get any foam on the lip.
And of course most homebrewers don't do any of those things, right? I mean, most people that are bottling are carbonating in the bottle, so they have no foam on the top, right?
So carbonating in the bottle, though, you've got that yeast scavenging.
Yeah, you do. That's right. Yeah.
Yeah. So that this whole experience was a great argument to carbonate in the bottle.
Ah, interesting. Because of course the fermentation as it goes to carbonate is going to take up some of that oxygen, hopefully all of it.
Yeah. Well, and that was another thing that we've talked a lot about with Sierra Nevada. Where does that oxygen go? Yeah. Right. In any part of the process, right? So let's say I picked up some oxygen in the can. I'm not fermenting the can. What happens to that? Well, a lot of it gets bound, especially in these really hoppy beers, a lot of it gets bound to the hops because the hops just love oxygen. And so if I were to measure a can, let's say I did two cans in a row exactly the same, and I measure one right now, and I measure one tomorrow, I'm going to get a much lower oxygen reading in the one tomorrow because the hops have picked up the oxygen. The problem with that is it's not a permanent bond. And you don't know if it's going to be a week later or a month later or 3 months later. But those hops will let go of that oxygen, and they will participate in the staling reactions, the wet cardboard flavor, the other staling reactions about with oxygen.
Interesting. Well, you sent me some other notes here. Let's cover another term you want to talk about was oxygen pickup. So can you talk about that?
So what the machine, what the C-Box measures is total package oxygen. Mm-hmm. Total package oxygen is all the oxygen that they can get, that the machine can get to react to the sensor. Now, some of that was already in the keg. So if we subtract what was already in the keg from what our reading was, then we get the oxygen pickup. So the oxygen pickup is what, as a brewer, we're trying to control because we don't have any control over what was in the keg, bright tank, or the carboy. But we do have control over how much we pick up. So it was good to keep those clear in our minds that, you know, hey, there's 25 or 28 PPB that we can't deal with here. But we don't really want it to go, let's say, over 48 and have 20 PPB of pickup. And we were really expecting, and we would have considered a successful test if we were getting 50 PPB of pickup. That would have been good enough for us. We were getting a lot of cans that were 10 PPB of pickup. Mm-hmm. Again, I would have loved to be able to run this thing all day long and get hundreds of samples. But it canned so quickly. We ran out of beer fast. Keg would just last a few minutes.
Wow.
And suddenly, you know, you have 100 cans of beer and you're going, oh, well, what if we tried that? And you set up to do it, and all of a sudden you have 100 cans of beer again.
Wow.
Of which we gave away to all the employees, which was
Well, that's nice. And you mentioned total package oxygen is a measure. It does change over time, so it goes down. And then does it rise again in the long term? How does that work?
So I didn't have the C-Box long enough to really see what it sees. What we do know, Sierra Nevada is really good about teaching about all this kind of stuff. I get to go there a lot. And what they've been telling us for years is, like, even if you have one iron molecule, and iron and oxygen bond together really well, that iron molecule is going to hold on to that oxygen for a really long time, but then it's going to let it go. And for their shelf stability program, what they've found is no iron in the product whatsoever. You know, you and I think about getting iron from the water. That's probably the most likely place we're going to pick up iron, mm-hmm. Maybe from a well jacket. They were picking it up from their filtration. They use DME for filtration. And even though they specify the lowest level of iron that you can get, they were picking up more iron than they could tolerate. Wow. And that's when they installed centrifuges, was when they found them out. Long time, 15 years ago.
So they centrifuge the iron out, I guess?
No, so they don't. They do pad filtration to get big chunks of hops out and things like that. Okay. And then they centrifuge the rest. And that actually leaves so little yeast that they still carbonate the pale ale in the bottle. And so for the pale ale, they do a cell count, dose it with yeast, and dose it with sugar. So they do a cell count and they do a CO2. They calculate how much CO2 they need. They add the right amount of yeast from their proprietary math for yeast cells that they need. And then they add enough sugar from standard math to get the carbonation level. And if you look at the bottom of a Sierra Nevada pale ale bottle, you'll see a paper thin layer of yeast.
Wow.
Which isn't their house yeast. That's their bottling yeast. They use two strains.
I had no idea that they naturally carbonated.
They still do. They always have, and they still do. Yeah. I believe it's the only big brewery that is. I can't think of
it. Yeah. Well, let's go through some practical things to reduce oxygen. You already talked a little bit about bottling, but let's talk about, for example, secondary transfers is a big source of oxygen, I would think, for most homebrewers that are transferring beer from keg to keg or from perhaps a fermenter to a secondary fermenter.
So yeah, or from a fermenter to a keg.
Yeah. Right?
You know, a lot of brewers I know will ferment. They'll push off into the keg, force carbonate into the keg, and then bottle for friends or competitions or whatever, sure, whenever they need beer to leave the house. And that was kind of how I worked. And so, you know, I've been thinking a lot about those processes. So, the fermentation has consumed the oxygen in the fermenter. As soon as the act of bubbling is done, you probably want to get that airlock off because it lets air both ways. Even though we don't think it does, it does. Mm-hmm. So you probably want to get your carboy or whatever your primary fermentation is capped off. If you have a PRV, you might want to cap off even when there's a little bit of activity left. If you're capped off and you're sitting at 1 PSI, it's probably a pretty ideal place to sit there if you're fermenting ales. And so then you know you're pretty stable there, but then you're going to transfer it off into something that you can work with, whether that be a keg or not. And we talked a lot about, so let's say we take the keg, pressurize it to 20 PSI, we vent it. We pressurize it again to 20 PSI, vent it.
Sure.
At the brewery, our carbonation line is 28 PSI. So we would pressurize bright tanks to 28 PSI. I would do that three times and think, well, I've got,
oxygen out.
Well, I've got 92% of the oxygen. That's the math I'd done years ago. And I thought that was a lot. And it turns out that's not very much oxygen. I'm still leaving a ton in the tank.
Yeah, I was going to say that is probably quite a bit of oxygen, right?
Yeah, that's quite a bit of oxygen talking about PPB. And yet I thought I was helping, and I probably wasn't. The other thing I would do is after it was full, I would purge it three times again. And that was probably helping a little, but all that stirring while I was transferring into the keg, all that stirring was probably pulling oxygen out of the headspace. At the brewery, our beer never leaves the building. It's always cold, so staling reactions are going to happen really slow. We serve our beers super fast. We don't age anything. So it probably didn't bite me in the butt yet. but yeah, that's still something we're looking at now. It's like, how do we do better? And one of the things that I've always done homebrewing, it's like, well, it's only 5 gallons, in a keg. Why not just fill the keg with water and push it out with CO2? Then I know there's no oxygen in the headspace. But all that residual water had all that oxygen in it.
The water's full of oxygen, yeah.
The water's full of oxygen, and you can't get it. You can't push it all out. And
does it help if you let it settle a little bit? I know. For example, CO2 is heavier than oxygen. Does it eventually settle and separate a little bit?
All the math I've done, and I haven't done any experiments with this. Yeah. All the math I've done says that CO2 blanketing can't be effective.
Okay.
That at the temperatures we're working with, the Brownian motion of the molecules is going to stir up that layer, that blanket.
Chaos reigns, huh?
Chaos reigns. Now, if we have a much bigger difference in density between blanketing gas and the atmosphere, then we actually do get a pretty good blanket, and we can blanket with argon really well. Argon, however, is super expensive.
Yeah, I was going to say probably not practical for a homebrewer.
No, but we see the winemakers around here use it a lot, and it is very effective, and they measure it and can measure that it's effective. But I don't see us going by argon as home.
So I'm trying to transfer, and I have a system where I can transfer directly out of the, like a conical fermenter, right, into the keg, and I'll purge the keg, and I can put CO2 pressure on the fermenter, but it's still not perfect, right?
It's still not even close to perfect.
Yeah,
and I think better would be to heat your water up to 210, bubble. So let's say you've got your boil kettle. You put 6 gallons of water in it. You heat it to 210. You hook up CO2 to the bottom. Give it a really good purge. Let it sit again, still at 210. Then fill your keg with it, and then push it all out.
Wow.
Then you might have, you know, if you're doing a barley wine where you're going to let it sit warm for a year or something like that, it's worth that much effort, I think. I think that the C-Box has taught us it's worth that much effort now.
Well, of course, the barley wine, sometimes the character it derives anyways from the malonoidins and so on is kind of this old wine character, and it comes from oxygen, but I
don't like the sherry character.
The sherry character, exactly, was what I was talking about. Yeah, interesting.
Yeah, that and I prefer it if we keep the sherry character out.
Yeah, well.
When I was first brewing, literally batch number one for me was a 10-year-old can of Cooper's Extra that a friend of mine had bought.
I think I did the same thing.
And it was the most sherry-tasting thing I've ever had in my life.
Yeah.
It tasted more like sherry than sherry.
That was probably oxidized before you even started brewing with it, though.
In the can, yeah. And probably because the headspace had so much oxygen.
Compare this to what we used to do, which is, you know, I used to take the beer and transfer it from a primary to a secondary fermenter, like a carboy or something like that. And then, you know, with no CO2 purge, of course. And then eventually it would make its way into a keg or a bottle. I mean, there must have been tons of oxygen in say an average homebrew of 10 years ago.
I think so. And you know, when I look at homebrew over, you know, the last 25 years, it has gotten much better. And there's lots of reasons for that. I think it's easier to get fresh extract. I think the brewers are much better at following standard practices. But there's still, I still run into a lot of beers at home festivals that have what I call homebrew character. And I wonder how much of that is attributable to oxygen.
Interesting. How long does it take? Let's say I'm making a beer and going to serve it fairly fresh. How long does it take to get for the oxygen to start to really affect the flavor of the beer, the stability of the beer, and so on?
In pro brewing, one of the things we do, we have a parameter that we call package stability. How long can we leave this beer in the trade before we have to worry about it? You know, so you might see a born on date, but that doesn't tell you what date to pull it from the trade. And in order to generate that number, they do two things. One is they actually age the beer and taste it. But the other thing they do is something called force aging. They've got these big chambers. They look like a cabinet. For some reason, they always have plexiglass doors. I think that's glass doors, so they know there's beer in there. I don't know why. But they run through a cycle of heating and cooling the beer.
Yeah.
And they can simulate 3 months of aging in a week. So I guess my answer is, how are you storing it? You're storing it all in a refrigerator, much longer than if you're just throwing it in your basement, and definitely much longer than if you're storing it in the trunk here. I did an experiment one time. I was thinking, well, you know, let's do the most faithful IPA we can do. You know, an IPA went around the Cape of Good Hope in a ship in a hold. I'm just going to take a case of beer and I'm going to throw it in the trunk of my car, commute to work for a month. Boy, that was the worst tasting.
Yeah, I know temperature cycling is one of the worst things you can do to your beer. You know, just bringing it up and down rapidly is not good.
Yeah, and it does force age. If a beer that has very little oxygen will survive that much better than a beer that has oxygen. And I think the heat convinces the oxygen to let go of the molecules is really what I think is happening. I don't know why the cooling part helps. But yeah, for some reason, the cycling is better than just holding.
Now I get this question all the time. Do we run into risks doing things like dry hopping where we're throwing, introducing oxygen, right into the finished beer, just by dry hopping?
Yes. We are adding a lot of oxygen right there. And one of the things we're seeing, for a number of reasons is people adding while there's still some active fermentation. a good rule of thumb, I think, for dry hopping now, we wouldn't have said this 15 years ago, is to wait till 2/3 of your gravity is consumed. And then let's say homebrewing or pro brewing, we work in Plato, but let me convert to SG in my head. So in specific gravity, let's say we're starting at 1060, we're going to drop down to 1015, maybe 1012 for West Coast IPA. So we like those West Coast IPAs nice and dry. When we got somewhere around 1025, 1030, that's when we'd put in the dry hops. And there's enough yeast still active that we're hoping that it would pull some oxygen. The bigger factor is we've learned that a lot of these hop molecules are bioactive, which means that the yeast can take some of these aromas, work on them, add bigger chains to them.
Yeah, there's biotransformations take place, right?
Yeah, exactly right. And that only happens if the yeast is still active. There's a lot of factors. It's strain dependent, both for yeast and for hops. But we do see a lot of that. We're actually learning a lot about hop chemistry. That would be a whole nother hour.
I've had a number of guests come on to talk about the importance of thiols, linalool, geraniol, biotransformations during active fermentation, and so on.
You know,
the
one that we kind of gloss over, which has been very interesting for me, is hops in the mash and in the boil can some of these molecules that should come off in the boil actually get glucose connected to them, and their evaporation rate, evaporation temperature goes up. You know, how much we lose during the boil goes down. Oh, then wow. They get into the fermenter, and the yeast can scavenge the sugar off them and release that aroma that we would think was gone. Huh. And that's something that we don't talk a lot about in the industry. We know it exists. We know that's probably how mash hopping works and first kettle hopping works, to bring in more aroma to the beer. But so far, it's not a big part of what we're talking about. Hmm.
And I assume you run the same risk adding like finings and additives in water afterwards as well, right?
Yeah. I used to
mix finings with a little tap water, and that's probably not a good idea.
No, terrible idea. Mix it with beer. Pull a sample of your beer and mix your findings in beer and then add them back. Hmm. Yeah. I did it too. I used to do silica and PVPP in tap water mixed with a blender. Never do that again.
With a blender, that's probably, you make it even worse.
Yeah, right.
Another question I often get, do oxygen absorbing bottle caps really do anything? So,
well, the short answer is yes, they do something. And we can measure that. As soon as they get wet, they do scavenge oxygen. Over the long term, they might release all that oxygen back out. And that's something that would take a fair amount of testing before I would incorporate them in the brewery. But the moment they get wet, they take all the oxygen. So let's say you take some tap water, you make up a sanitizer, and you sanitize those caps. Well, all that oxygen scavenging is done at that point. It's not going to do anything after that. It probably just holds that oxygen so that you can cap it onto your beer. So if you're using them dry out of a new package, you might get some scavenging, but it might release it after a week or month.
Interesting. What about hot side aeration? We haven't really opened that topic. We did talk a little bit about, obviously you need oxygen during fermentation, but hot side aeration has been a sort of a controversial topic for many years. Some people say it's really no big deal. I think I had some guests on saying, you know, it's important, but it's only important if you got everything else fixed first. So how big a deal is hot side aeration, which of course is where you introduce oxygen into the wort before it's been fermented?
Well, yeah, so fix everything first. I think that's great advice, right? You know, it's not the night day difference that package oxygen is. However, what I've found, you know, I can't eliminate all the oxygen. I don't have the ability to wet mill. I don't have the ability to put a floating lid on my mash. Ways that we could really make some dramatic oxygen reductions. But I do have the ability to put in oxygen scavenging chemicals in. I don't know if you guys have talked about Trifecta Blend.
No, I haven't.
Fascinating thing. They basically mix ascorbic acid, a tannin that I was always told comes from burl wood, but now I think it comes from somewhere else now. What's the other one? Sulfites. So they take a blend of those three and they add them to the strike water. And that scavenges all the oxygen out while you're stirring the mash, so that all the air that's trapped in the husks that's making all that foam on the top of your mash tun, that all gets scavenged out. And then if you have a dissolved oxygen meter, you might take a reading after mashing and do it one more time before you start to boil.
Mm-hmm.
These, if you have an oxygen meter, these are good home methods to utilize. What's the website that talks into that? What is it? Modern Brew House, maybe?
Maybe. I don't know.
These guys are great. They go through all the papers. I bring them up a lot. Pardon me. I bring them up a lot, and they've contacted me before, and every time they do, it's like, wow, really? I should be paying attention to that too. They always shock me. And one of the ones, I always get Teague on the top of my mashes, and that's considered in my world, the way I was taught, that if you have Teague on the top, that means you're using your mash as a filter effectively. Teague is this really fine powder protein, and you can see these little layers of it after recirculation at the top of the mash tun.
Mm-hmm.
And I was talking about it with one of these guys, and whose name escapes me, I'm sorry. And he's like, oh yeah, if you see Teague, you've got oxygen. That you just do not get Teague without oxygen. And I'm like, wait a minute. I've seen that in 1,200 batches in a row. You mean I've got to do better? and literally on batch 1243, we changed and tried to limit the amount of Teague we were creating by using Trifecta. We don't have an oxygen meter at the house. So for us, we have to do it like a home, but in guess. And taste. And what we're finding is the more we do to lower hot side aeration, the more brilliant our malt character is. You know, we're a brew pub, so we don't buy malt based on cost. We only buy malt based on flavor, because we're selling everything across the bar. So saving, 10 cents a pound isn't going to make any difference to the bottom line to us. So we buy the most beautiful malts we can get, and they're better if we focus on HSA.
Well, that's one of the questions I was going to ask. What are the effects of hot side aeration? It's not the same, obviously, as packaged oxygen.
No, not at all. And for me, my friend Brian talks about many processes. Brian Hunt at Moonlight Brewing talks about many processes this way. But this is a great example of where I can use his metaphor. Drinking a beer with a lot of HSA is like listening to a concert from the parking lot. You know, yeah, you can hear the music. You know the music's there. You know the musicians are good. But boy, when you get inside the concert hall, it sure sounds a lot better. And that's what malt character, that's the difference in malt character for me. It's like, yeah, I can taste all those malts, but boy, if I get rid of all the HSA, it's like having that concert feeling right in front of you. You've got that beautiful layers of malt, of biscuit and nutty and all of these characters that we look for, but they're separate. They're not blended together. They're separate. They're bright and they're distinguishable, and I love it. And cool. I think it's worth all the effort that you went through.
Nice. Well, how can I tell if my beer has oxygen problems? What are the off flavors I should really look for?
So the classic one that we teach in light lagers and it works in light ales too, is wet paper, wet cardboard. And you can, the Siebel tasting kit's got some great examples in it of those characters. And I really encourage everybody to do some flavor training. You know, we have these, there's the short and shoddy program that that goes around, and people are like, oh yeah, we couldn't taste the difference in these. And it's like, well, you should have tasted the difference in that experiment. And if you didn't, it was your lack of training, not that that it's an acceptable brewing practice. And and I kind of get into that argument. It, with, not in all of their topics, because some of the topics I really do believe that, that yeah, it probably doesn't make that big of a difference. But some of them, you should have been trained to taste this before you were asked to actually taste these beers. Because once you're a trained taster, there's lots of things that are very obvious. And one of the first things you should be trained to taste is light skunking and the paper character.
Cardboard, yeah. I use those kits during the BYO boot camps that I teach occasionally, and they are excellent. And it's always amazing. There's only typically out of the whole class, there's typically like one or two people that get all the flavors right.
You know, when I do that training, and I do that training a lot too, I do I'll take six that I want to train.
Yeah,
and I do it in 3 days, and on day one, it's double the threshold. And we talk about it. We talk about all the flavors. On day two, it's at threshold. And mm-hmm. on day three, it's at half threshold.
Wow.
And I am amazed how many tasters can pick up below threshold levels of some of these compounds. I knew a woman one time that could do diacetyl at a hundredth of threshold.
Some people are very sensitive to that. And so that you know, that's an issue.
And to, you know, for me, you know, acetaldehyde is a green apple character. I kind of like it. To me, it makes a beer taste fresh.
Yeah.
So I tend not to care if it's in my beer. But some people are super sensitive to it, so I do taste for it. I do make sure it doesn't exist in.
Yeah.
I can create it at will in beer. So I've intentionally brewed some beers with it. Nothing I'll do anymore.
Well, Colin,
and that was all because a taster just was so annoyed by it.
Yeah. Some people are very sensitive to certain flavors. I know, for example, some people don't like buttered popcorn, which obviously would be, I wouldn't like diacetyl, you know.
Well, an imitation butter is diacetyl.
Yes, it is. Absolutely.
You know, and one more thing, if we can sneak it in, we did talk about the third spot of oxygen, and we might as well flush that out just a tiny sure. bit. So when we're adding oxygen to make yeast healthy, it's super important. And really what we're doing is we're rebuilding the sterol reserves. So at the right. end of fermentation, yeast will try to use its last energy to make sterols. It's how it's basically its battery. It's how it's storing energy to be healthy when it gets used again. And as we're storing yeast wet, those sterol reserves get depleted so that the yeast cell can stay healthy. So what we want to do is we want to give it some oxygen. We want to give it some time, that lag time, to build its sterols, and then use it. Well, we found that in the industry now, we found there's another way to do that, and that is you take yeast that's at the peak of its sterol levels, and you dry it. So all the dry yeast manufacturers now are recommending no oxygen with dry yeast.
Interesting. I did not know that.
Yeah, I thought that was very interesting too, and I did a bunch of experiments at Moorbeer. It's like, well, can we teach this? Can we say this? And I was pitching on big beers, you know, a double IPAs, and you know, so I did a pale ale, I did a double IPA, I did a pale ale, an IPA, and a double IPA, and pitched on them, no oxygenation, no hydration. Just simply pour it on the beer through the carboy neck and put an airlock on it. And then we took the whole staff into tastings with it. Mm-hmm. And we all liked the ones with no oxygen the best.
Wow. I will add
that with liquid yeast.
I will add a caveat to that, though, is if you get to the very, very high gravities, like if you're making wines and very high gravity meads, you actually do need to, you do need to slowly introduce it, and that has to do with osmotic shock.
Exactly, yeah. Right. So there is a limit to that, and we tested it all the way up to 1080.
Yeah. But when you get into like wines and, you know, there's meads I make that are some of them start at like 1150, 1160.
Totally different
realm. Yeah.
Even at 1100, I would be.
Right. Adding, so again, yeah, if you're making wine, hydration. You may want to consider slowly introducing that yeast.
And adding nutrients to hydration.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, Colin, it's great to have you on the show. Would just really quick your closing thoughts.
You know, I think home brewing has a lot of room for growth, and I think we're going to still see people taking pro innovations, bringing them to the home level, and using them to win competitions. Even though pro brewing and home brewing has become more homogenized than ever, I still think the pro guys have some good things that we're going to be able to disseminate down to. We're going to still see home brewing get better. I think, you know, we talked a little bit about home brewing itself as a shrinking market, but what I'm seeing is the average beer is getting better and better and better, and has for 25 years. The average beer now at a festival is much better than the average beer 25 years ago. I think a lot of that is because of the work you're doing and work that people are doing to disseminate good information out in the public, and I really appreciate it.
Well, thank you, Colin. Really, really great to have you on the show again. A pleasure.
Thank you for having me.
My guest today was Colin Kaminsky. Colin is a pro brewer at Downtown Joe's and co-author of the book Water, A Comprehensive Guide for Brewers. Colin, thank you once again.
Oh, gosh, my pleasure.
A big thank you to Colin Kaminsky for joining me this week. Thanks also to Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine. They invite you to join their upcoming brewery workshop, March 24th to 27th in Austin, Texas. This one-of-a-kind event brings together professional brewers to help you start or grow your own craft brewery. To learn more, please visit breweryworkshop.com. Again, that's breweryworkshop.com. And also the American Homebrewers Association. The Homebrewers Association invites you to join today and get a free bonus book. Join for 1 year and select a free brewing book from more than 60 titles to match your fermentation goals. Visit homebrewersassociation.org to join the American Homebrewers Association and treat your shelf to a new book. And Beersmith Web, the online version of Beersmith Brewing Software. Beersmith for the Web lets you design great beer recipes from any browser, including your tablet or phone. Edit recipes on the go with access to the same full suite of recipe building tools as our desktop version. Try Beersmith Web today by creating a free account at beersmithrecipes.com. And finally, that reminder to click the like or subscribe button on YouTube, iTunes, Spotify, or whatever platform you're on. Clicking those buttons is a great way to support the show. I'd like to thank you for listening, and I hope you have a great brewing week.